I'm Tony Cox, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Well, it's time now for Tell Me More's weekly visit to the barber shop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs this week are freelance writer Jimmy Israel, syndicated columnist, civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, Sports Illustrated reporter Pablo Torre, and none other than NPR's political editor Ken Rudin. Jimmy, you got it, bro.
Hey, what's up, Tony? Back again for the first time.
And
what's up, man?
I got my Laker hat on, too, buddy.
Oh, well, whatever, man. Yo, fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing? How's everybody else?
Hey, Jimmy.
How's it going, man?
Ken Dog's in the house. Okay, well, you know what? Let's jump right in and talk about the big news this week. President Obama relieving General Stanley McChrystal, the U.S. commander in Afghanistan, of his duties. Dude. On Wednesday, just pulled the plug on him.
Absolutely. Hey, Jimmy, you know, we touched on this earlier in the political chat. The firing of General McChrystal came after Rolling Stone magazine, of course, published some disparaging remarks by McChrystal and some of his subordinates about key administration personnel, including President Obama. So here is President Obama speaking on Wednesday about McChrystal's resignation.
All Americans should be grateful for General McChrystal's remarkable career in uniform. But war is bigger than any one man or woman, whether a private, a general, or a president. And as difficult as it is to lose General McChrystal, I believe that it is the right decision for our national security. The conduct represented in the recently published article does not meet the standard that should be set by a commanding general. It undermines the civilian control of the military that is at the core of our democratic system.
Hey, Jimmy.
Yes, Tony.
Finally, the president takes somebody important to the woodshed. Finally.
That's one read, Tony. I mean, it's hard, but it's fair. You know what I mean? It's one of those things. You know, Ken Dog, did General McChrystal kind of force Obama's hand in this case? Did he force the president to fire him?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, as you heard in President Obama's remarks, there is a time-honored adherence to the civilian control of the military. Douglas MacArthur learned it the hard way in 1951. The generals in 7 Days in May, that movie, they learned it that way too. And you know something, we talk about President Obama's lack of he just never seemed to want to get involved. He maybe stayed on the sidelines far too long during the healthcare debate. He waited almost 2 months before he met with the guys, the head of BP. So everybody was saying, you know, do something. This was a sign, a clear sign from the president that his decision was made and he was going to act accordingly.
A-Train.
Yeah, you know, former French Prime Minister Georges Clemenceau once said that war is too important to be left to the generals. And it's important to keep in mind that civilian control of the military is something that is part and parcel and sacrosanct aspect of our American democratic society. And, you know, what General Stanley McChrystal said in the Rolling Stone article, which is called The Runaway General by Michael Hastings, was essentially insubordination. You know, here you had a subordinate, you know, talking smack not only about the commander-in-chief, but also the rest of his national security team, you know, basically saying that national security advisor Jim Jones was stuck in 1985 like Marty McFly and that, you know, Dick Holbrooke.
A clown.
Yeah, a clown. Dick Holbrooke, you know, was like a wounded animal, things like that. And so, you know, it was, you know, conduct unbecoming. And what Fareed Zakaria of Newsweek magazine, you know, coined to be a master stroke, he replaced him with General David Petraeus, someone who is widely regarded both here inside the Beltway and outside the Beltway as an amazing commander. And so I think that, you know, by replacing McChrystal with Petraeus, he's going to take some of the heat off of the resignation of McChrystal.
You know what, Pablo? You know, that great American Geraldo Rivera, he made this interesting point on Fox News that I think it bears fleshing out. He says that he thinks that Rolling Stone did the country a great disservice by having journalist Michael Hastings kind of flush these quote-unquote comments that could have been taken off the record can kind of flesh these out in the public sphere. Well, how do you feel about that?
I'm going to have to disagree with the great American Geraldo Rivera because for the sole reason that this was excellent journalism. I mean, this was the point of the industry, and I applaud Michael Hastings. And I also wonder, as far as the service goes, I mean, I think what this revealed as far as McChrystal goes is that there's something of a character defect in the man. I mean, not to get too personal, I don't know him. I only know of him through these reports, but anybody who did not, I mean, I think we can all agree that he didn't fall on the sword. This is not something, an outcome that he wanted. He did not want to be fired. And if we operate from that perspective, the question is, what was his margin for error? What was he thinking, right? Why would he even say those things?
Hey, before you get to the next one, let me just remind people what they are listening to. This is The Barbershop, if you didn't already know that. You're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News, our weekly segment called The Barbershop. And we are speaking with journalists Jimmy Israel, Ken Rudin, Arsalan Iftikhar, and Pablo Torre. Okay, Jimmy, you got it back.
Yeah, Tony, I wonder if it's just me. Did anybody else have shades of Jesse Jackson in 1984 when the Post ambushed him with anti-Semitic comments he thought he'd made off the record and that ended up in the paper?
Oh, no. Can I jump in on this?
Go ahead, Ken.
First of all, the Jesse Jackson thing was a private conversation that Milton Coleman of the Washington Post decided to report. It was a private conversation. What's so amazing about this is General McChrystal, who may be a great general, and everybody says he is, and it goes beyond what Pablo just said about excellent journalism, he sat there with a journalist and just ripped apart his commander-in-chief.
For a month.
Right. And this is chronic.
How do you do that?
Well, he was embedded. Michael Hastings was embedded with McChrystal and his crew for a month. He even went to Paris
to the volcano.
Yeah. When his crew was getting drunk and wasted and saying these things. I mean, it's not like the guy was there for 2 days and he was out. He was there for a month. They knew exactly who he was.
And the great irony here is that General Petraeus, who the left hated, remember that he was General Betrayus, the MoveOn.org thing? Senator Obama was not a fan of his. Now Petraeus could save a policy that, for all I know, hasn't changed, and it still looks like there's no satisfactory conclusion to it.
Well, Jimmy, before you go on, I have a hard time understanding how someone as smart as Stanley McChrystal could allow this to happen as a oops kind of thing.
Exactly, and that's my question, too. I'm baffled by it.
All right. Well, you want to move on to another thing? Go ahead.
Yeah, let's keep it in motion. Let's jump to talking about Gary Faulkner, my dude.
Oh, man.
Now, in case you forgot, he's the American arrested in the mountains of Pakistan last week with a 40-inch sword, a pistol, and night vision goggles. He is apparently Shaft. on a solo mission hunting Osama bin Laden. Wow.
Absolutely.
You know, and now he's back in Colorado resting.
You're right about that. He's been dubbed, in fact, the Rocky Mountain Rambo. You know, there'll be a movie coming. You know it will. Gary Faulkner has hinted he may try again to catch bin Laden. Now, remember, the U.S. has placed a bounty of $25 million on the al-Qaeda leader's capture. Here's Faulkner talking to CNN about his mission.
There's people out there talking smack. Oh, he's crazy or this or that. You know what? Those are the people sitting on their ass talking shit. They'll sit there and say, well, that quarterback should have done this or this guy should have done that. But you know what? I got off my butt and I put my life on the line to go out there. I stood up for what I believed.
Well, thank you for that, Tony.
I guess
you know what? The problem with that A-Train is that there is no international bounty hunting license, as the Dog Chapman found out a few years back in Mexico. You know, they have another name for bounty hunting overseas. It's called kidnapping. Mm-hmm. Go ahead and get that, A-Train. What's up with that?
Well, you know, Gary Faulkner, first of all, if you look at him, he looks like, you know, the stunt double for Tommy Chong. And, let's not forget that not only is he a 50...
That's actually accurate.
He's a 50-year-old unemployed construction worker and ex-convict from Colorado.
Perfect.
Who was essentially caught with, you know, his Highlander samurai sword and night vision goggles in, you know, the hinterlands of Pakistan. If he goes back, you know, I'm more afraid that he's going to, you know, end up in some, like, back bazaar of Peshawar, like Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd in Spies Like Us and sucking his thumb somewhere. I'm just happy that, you know, he got out alive. I mean, our Navy SEALs, our special forces, you know, and drone attacks weren't able to catch Osama bin Laden. I don't think that this knucklehead could.
Well, I don't know. Pablo, my whole thing is nobody's hiring. Well, why knock this guy for, like, trying to hustle
you know
up the
what?
Rent?
You
I
know
mean,
what?
Seriously.
I watched that CNN interview, and there is definitely – it may be a perverted, but a hint of the, you know, the Rooseveltian, you know, it's not the critic who counts, but the guy in the arena who actually takes matters into his own hands. That, I mean, granted, the guy sounded, by all accounts, unhinged. And you know, we're talking about movies. I just can't decide if this is going to be a comedy or a drama. I mean, the guy is, seems, again, disturbed from afar. And, you know, my favorite quote actually was from his family, who, when they asked, you know, does this guy have any combat training? They're like, oh, no. But he's excellent with a sword, which just reminded me of, like, Napoleon Dynamite. You know,
Let me ask you this question, Jimmy and the guys. Suspend reality for just a second. What if he had been successful?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
I love that question.
What if he had been successful? I mean, I think it's a bad read to look at this guy and say he was disturbed. I think this guy, whether you like it or not, is a patriot. And we can argue his method. We can even argue his look. But I mean, he's right. We're all sitting here belly aching about Bin Laden, and he's going out and trying to get him. So
yeah.
Hey,
yeah, let me tell you
what's, go get him.
What's more incredulous?
Go ahead, Ken.
John McCain during the 2008 presidential debate said, "I'll get Osama bin Laden, my friends. I know how to get him. I know how to do it." But he didn't have a sword. He didn't have night goggles. At least Faulkner knew what he was doing.
Well, and also let's not forget, you know, that this concept of mercenaries. I mean, with the advent of Blackwater, which is now called Z. You know, we have, you know, essentially soldiers a fortune, you know, running around the country, right. Running around the world, both in Iraq, Afghanistan, all over the world, you know, running around as mercenaries. And, you know, I think that this Gary Faulkner guy got caught up in that mercenary rush.
Yeah, I think that's the one big problem. There is no such thing as international bounty hunting license. You know, you just can't go to another country and just start randomly rustling, you know, criminals like your Luke Skywalker or somebody like that. I mean, you need some kind of stamp from the government.
But you know what he did do? What he did do was bring attention.
Note from your mother.
He did bring attention and shine the spotlight on Osama bin Laden, who honestly had fallen out of the conversation. I mean, the fact that we're even talking about bin Laden because of an effort like this, I think is admirable in some way, regardless of what you think of the guy's pathologies.
You know, if Faulkner had to find something, he should find the offense for the Washington Nationals. That's been missing for a long time. Where's that going?
Well, you know, right. I tell you what, before you get to the next topic, I mentioned that there might be a movie, but I really could see a reality show. You know, you want to become a mercenary, you want to learn how to go and get bin Laden, you know, tune in every night.
Wow.
All right, Jimmy, what are we going to talk about next?
I might be on it. All right, well, moving along. I'm not a big tennis fan, but I can tell you one thing for sure. You won't catch me playing a match that lasts 11 hours and 5 minutes, but that's what happened in Wimbledon this week in a game that started on Tuesday, resumed on Wednesday, and finally finished yesterday, Tony.
It absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I watched it. I didn't watch all of it, obviously not, because I do have a life, but I did watch the end.
So.
I watched the end of it. So, of course, you're talking about the match between John Isner and Nicolas Mahut, a Frenchman, I believe.
Nicolas Mahut.
Thank you very much. And not only was it the longest match ever, it also holds the record for the most games in a set, the most games in a match, and the most combined aces. Now, the previous record for length of a match at Wimbledon was 6 hours, 33 minutes. Man, oh, man, that's a long time to sit.
Man, I thought my second divorce was long. So, Pablo, was this actually a competitive match, or was this just about bad tennis gone far too long?
You know, I'm not going to say it was good or excellent tennis. You know, the match widely regarded as the best was Federer-Nadal at Wimbledon, and that was 16-14. But what this was is compelling in a completely different way. You know, serves weren't often broken. There were you know, so many aces does not necessarily equate to great tennis and great rallies. But my rule for events like this is that any time the scoreboard is not formatted to display what your match is doing, that is automatically a great sports moment. That's Nadia Comaneci in the Olympics with a 10.0. That's strikeout records. That's long baseball games. And this game, this match, was longer than any baseball game in history. 11 hours. It's rare to see two people just meet basically a perfect equilibrium. Really a matter of stubbornness as much as it was skill. And to me, that was incredible.
I actually watched it. You know, I was watching U.S. Algeria World Cup on TV, and I had my laptop on my lap watching this unbelievable, redunculous match. I mean, Pablo talks about the 2009 epic final, which ended 16-14. I remember in 2003, during the Australian Open quarterfinals, Andy Roddick beat Yunus Alanawi 21-19, and this was 70-68.
Well, wait, Arsalan.
This was like
don't you have a life?
No, I don't. This was like an This was
thanks
like
for that, Tony.
This was like an NBA game going 14 overtime.
Can I just mention something about the World Cup, though? I just found out Joe Barton ahead, just apologized to the Algerians. I just wanted to point that out. Sorry.
It's not going to do them any good. Amazing. But, I mean, honestly, like, this was this was tantric tennis at its best.
It was great.
I mean,
wow.
This was unbelievable.
Well, I guess they are the new Iron Men of tennis, these two guys, right?
No doubt. Mm.
There's something.
The Superman.
Whatever, man.
Nobody broke serve. That was the amazing part of it. For, you know, 138 games in the fifth set, you know, Isner had over 100 aces. Mahou had over 100 aces. They shattered every record in the book. They couldn't break each other's serve. This wasn't bad tennis. This was amazing tennis.
I've had relationships that didn't last as
right.
long.
So Isner, know, right? So what happened? Isner gets knocked out in the next round? Yeah. What happens? Yeah. Right?
It doesn't matter. He's already made the annals of history.
Sure.
Well, I guess that and 25 cents will get you what?
right, exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
I mean, you might make you king of the bar.
A license to kill Osama bin Laden, I guess.
Plus night goggles.
Hey, listen, guys, we've got to get out of here. But before we do, Jimmy, let me just jump in and say, you know, the whole country, some parts of the country are talking about the fact that today is the anniversary of the death of Michael Jackson. And I know, I see that you got your Michael Jackson shirt on, Ken Rudin, and I see you've got your
got
Michael Jackson glove on and all of that. So, did you know that he made $1 billion in the last year?
I don't make that in 5 years.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
$1 billion with
I just hope the money's up in the right place at this point. Right?
Music for memorabilia, videos, documentary films. Even the people who had tickets to the concert in London that was canceled.
Right.
Didn't turn them in to get refunds because they kept it as keepsakes. You know what that was worth? $6.5 million.
I guess this really was it, wasn't it?
He's a money machine. And that's really what he was. He was a singing, dancing, crotch-grabbing money machine, money-making machine.
His father is here today in Cleveland doing multiple appearances. I'm sure he's not doing it for charity.
Not the Jackson way.
I mean, the most recognizable.
We got a roll, guys.
Most recognizable face on the earth.
Absolutely. Jimmy Israel, freelance journalist and author of the book The Denzel Principle, joining us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Pablo Torre, a reporter for Sports Illustrated, joining us from our New York bureau. Arsalan Iftikhar here with me in our D.C. studios, the founder of themuslimguide.com. He is also a legal fellow for the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, and Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor. He, too, joined us here in Studio B, 4B. Good conversation, guys. Thanks.
Peace.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Yep.
That's our program for today. I'm Tony Cox, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is back to talk more on Monday.